Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. And today we have a special report from Flood the System Direct Action in the San Francisco Financial District. Karen Nyhus, my co-host, was there interviewing people. And today's action was called Flood Wall Street West, and it's the opening mobilization in a series of direct actions to be held this fall leading up to the COP, the Conference of the Parties 21, in Paris in November and December. Today's action targeted what organizers call climate profiteers, that is, banks and corporations profiting from dirty energy, including Wells Fargo Bank and Chevron Corporation. The music was provided by the Brass Liberation Orchestra. For more information about this and future actions, go to floodthesystem.net. And now, here's Karen in the San Francisco Financial District.
This is Karen Nyhus with Post Carbon Radio. I'm here in San Francisco's Financial District with the Flood Wall Street West demonstration. This is the opening demonstration of at least a season of activism about climate change involving direct action and confronting system change instead of climate change, and particularly today, confronting the corporations, including banks, that profit from dirty energy and climate change. So today we're going to bring you some voices and sounds from the streets of San Francisco in the opening action of Flood the System, known as Flood Wall Street West.
With our First Nations relatives, they have been fighting against the tar sands and against the fossil fuel industries, trying to, they're also trying to build new ports from coming in, so they're totally protecting and defending Mother Earth from that happening. Just last week, actually, Penny Plant, one of the grandmothers of Ida No More, San Francisco Bay, along with other environmental activists, went up to North Dakota. And up in North Dakota is my territory, the Arikara people. And up there, it's the Vulcan oil. And they are destroying and poisoning all the air and the water that my people have to live through. And we need to stop that.
Yeah, that's right.
And along with that, as you all may know about the Animas River too, how the Navajo Nation are really, really in great danger with all the fresh water that's been poisoned by the mine spill. So they're also protecting, defending their people from trying to get answers and everything like that. And just yesterday, a huge, huge action out in New York happened that brought the Amazon, Canada, and the U.S. women to sign this treaty for protecting and defending Mother Earth's rights of America. So I want to thank out there, all the people out there that's really doing great things for Mother Earth and for all our people who cannot be out there today. So I really want to thank all of you here today. This really means a lot to me because I see a lot of you are a little older, but I'm glad that all of you are doing this to help my people, to help my generation and younger, so we can all have a greater future. So, they owe to the city. Yeah. And I remember, our members are mostly refugees from Laos. So they were forced to leave their homeland from U.S. imperialist wars in Asia. And now they're living in the U.S. and they're suffering at the hands of corporate greed. And they're struggling. Many of our members are sick with asthma, with cancer, with other diseases. And this is all at the hands of the capitalist system. Many of them are forced to move because the rent's too high in the Bay Area and we're facing gentrification even out in Richmond. This is why we're not just fighting. Like, we don't want to just go stand in front of Chevron over and over again like we've been doing for the last 20 years. We don't want it to keep protesting. We really want to be organizing to build the solutions that we need. We want to be fighting for a just transition away from this extractive economy and towards an economy that's more sustainable for people. We're more relating to one another, and we're able to survive and feed our families. I just was in I was just in the West Bank in Palestine for a climate change seminar, and so we were our climate adaptation seminar, and so we were talking to the farmers and the Bedouin people who are shepherds who live off the land, and they're really on the front lines of this climate crisis and of the drought, of all these conditions and occupation, militarization, all this. And what one Bedouin man said to me was something like that there's a saying in his culture that what rises will fall, and that's going to be true of capitalism. And I was really shocked because one of our members, Lipu Chantanasak, a Laotian refugee, he always says almost the exact same thing, except he says it comes from Buddhism. And so what I realized is that whether people are speaking in Arabic or speaking in Lao or they're coming from Richmond or Palestine, oppressed people of the world speak the same language.
Right.
And they know that nothing lasts forever, especially not this system, and especially not when people are organizing and working together and standing up together.
Woo! Woo!
So thank you, everybody. I'm so glad to see so many people out here. Let's shut down, you know, let's flood the system. Let's shut down Bank of the West. Let's shut down Chevron. Let's go. So thank you, everybody. Have a great March.
Yeah.
From Oakland.
And what brought you here today?
Well, we got to do something, you know, to stand up and clean up things, stop climate change. There's a lot of talk about it, talk about being green and everything, but the fact of the matter is that every year, 2% more pollutants are dumped into our atmosphere than the year before. So consciousness has been raised, but we need to have action.
And what do you think about this type of action today? How does that rate with you?
I think it's a good idea. I'd like to see a lot more people.
All right, this is the first action, right, in a series of actions for Flood Wall Street. What's your hope for the future?
More and more people have to take direct action. including nonviolent civil disobedience. We cannot let them keep doing business as usual because our species is heading for extinction.
And what do you consider direct action? What's direct action to you? You mentioned nonviolent civil disobedience. Are there other forms?
Yes, I mean, marching is a direct action. There's lots of types of direct action. But if you just let somebody represent you, then that's not direct action.
All right. Anything else you'd like to add today?
Well, the motto of the IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, is an injury to one is an injury to all.
You see that playing out in climate change?
Absolutely.
How?
Because it affects all of us, and, you know, sometimes, you know, it might just be somebody who's near a polluter who's directly affected in an obvious way, but it affects us all, so we have to stand up. An injury to one is an injury to all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello.
All right, so what's your name and where are you from?
I'm Lawrence Shoup. I live in Oakland, California.
And why are you here today?
Obviously, we have a crisis in the world, the whole climate crisis, the ecological crisis, which if we're not, don't make some changes, humanity itself is going to be at risk within a relatively short time when we're talking about geologic time, a few decades. Humanity's going to be at risk because we have an overheated planet. Remember James Hansen, the great guy from NASA who's been talking about this. Remember that he first studied Venus. And Venus, you know, that's when he got the connection, you know, that, hey, the United States, I mean, the world is overheating just like Venus. So obviously this is a very serious problem and we all need to be doing something about it. I have two grandkids and I don't want them to grow up on an overheated planet when it's going to be hard to find enough food, water, you know, to live.
So, and what do your grandkids think? What do they know?
Well, they're very young.
Okay. How about your kids?
Well, my son is you know, not as active as I am, but certainly thinks the same way I do, yeah. This is a very serious crisis that we all have to pitch in, and the problem really is capitalism, because it's an expansive system for a finite planet. Those two don't go together. You can't expand forever on a finite planet, and capitalism depends on, it's an expand or die system. It depends on expansion. So there's a contradiction there that's eventually going to catch up with humanity, and we're going to be doomed if we don't do something about it. So we have to change capitalism, which means overthrowing it, because its very nature is to expand. They're always talking about growth, growth, growth. Well, you can't grow forever on a finite planet. It's impossible. You're going to have a crisis sooner or later. A crisis is coming. It's already upon us. We're already seeing serious problems with flooding, with droughts, with massive storms, etc. So, anyway, I wrote this book because the Council on
the book is what?
Is Wall Street's think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal neoliberal Geopolitics, 1976 to 2014. Since 1976, the capitalists in this country, in cooperation with other capitalists, and the Council on Foreign Relations is their leading planning organization. It's the consensus-forming. It's the most powerful private organization in the world, the Council on Foreign Relations. And people just haven't heard about it. Anyway, they plan U.S. foreign policy and increasingly U.S. domestic policy. In my book, I show that 80% of U.S. leaders since 1976, top government leaders in the United States, 80% are members of this organization, which people would not suspect, you know, because you might look at PBS and it says so-and-so talking about Iraq or Syria or something from the Council on Foreign Relations. They never say what the Council on Foreign Relations is. It's a policy planning and membership organization run by and for the capitalist class of the United States.
So how do you think CFR compares to other elite global institutions like the Trilateral Commission or the Bilderberg Group?
They're all connected. It's in my book, Chapter 4 is on the Council's international connection. And the Bilderbergers, of course, David Rockefeller was a key, he was the chairman of the council. He was an original Bilderberger from 1953 when it was first founded in the Netherlands. by Prince Barnard and others, and the Council on Foreign Relations, the very high percentage of all the Bilderbergers, whether the name is Kissinger or David Rockefeller or Brzezinski or any number of them, they're members and leaders of the Council on Foreign Relations. And the Trilateral Commission was started by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski in 1973. At the Bilderberger, they asked the Bilderbergers, who were mostly European nobles. That's what's not mentioned about the Bilderbergers. They're European nobles with an assist from the U.S., you know, capitalist class. Anyway, Rockefeller and Brzezinski said, you know, the Japanese are getting, in the 70s, the Japanese are getting powerful. We should bring them into the Bilderberger. The Bilderberger nobles from Europe said, oh, no, we don't want Japanese. So they founded the Trilateral. That's in my chapter 4, which covers the Davos also. You know, there's a lot of international institutions that the Council is very closely interlocked with.
So what do you say to people say to you, oh, that's just sort of elite conspiracy theory, that's been discredited, yeah, that's not really how things work systemically?
It's never been discredited. Some right-wingers have made some strange statements about it, like these people are socialists. Of course they're not, unless we say socialism is government owning the roads or something. That's not socialism, really. Because of their strange people that, you know, accuse them of being socialists, so then it gets discredited. But remember, conspiracies, so-called conspiracies, exist every time you organize a union or every time your Volkswagen decides they're going to cheat on the emissions. Conspiracies are very common in the world. If you define conspiracy as people getting together to defend their own interests, and that's what you're having here. You're having very, very powerful people getting together to magnify their power in an organization, and that's the Council on Foreign Relations.
All right. So back to climate and this demonstration. Any final comments you'd like to make about your presence here, or your hope for Flood the System, or what it represents to you?
Well, I hope that Flood the System becomes very large, because we need mass direct action to really change things. The political system is not very democratic in our country. Big money rules, even if you have insurgents from the outside sometimes, or peripheral figures like Bernie Sanders, they don't get very far because they don't have the big money, they don't have the organization, they don't have the media, they don't have the advisors that, you know, Clinton will have, Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush. So my prediction is those two will emerge eventually. Trump will fall. That's my prediction. We'll see what happens, but that was my prediction back in 2008. I looked at the analysis of who was behind who. The Council on Foreign Relations candidates were Barack Obama, who got a lot of money from Goldman Sachs, Hillary Clinton, and John McCain. And they're the ones who got furthest in the presidential campaign. Our democracy is largely a hollowed-out shell, so-called democracy. People vote every 2 or 4 years. No, the real democracy is direct democracy. The assemblies of workers running the society, that's real democracy, direct democracy. And we have to have mass action because the political democracy is so shallow and so controlled.
All right, Lawrence Shoup, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Sharon Delgado, and I'm from Nevada City, California.
And who'd you come with today?
I came with my husband and a friend and met some other friends down here.
And I see that you're holding a very big parachute-like object. What is it?
Yes. It's a parachute that has words about stopping climate chaos and stopping big oil. We also have the earth that we're bouncing up and down and saving this balloon that is colored as the earth. It's symbolic of what we're trying to do here today.
And why did you come all the way from Nevada City for this demonstration?
Because I think it's really important for people to be out in the streets to demonstrate how important it is to stop climate change at this time.
Justice and one in the same. I'm the best of the grace, introduced Dennis. Justice, to find love. Go after Wells Fargo. Go after Wells Fargo. We won't stop Wells Fargo. We want Wells Fargo. We want to make sure that you understand that you live in a community who cares. But we don't care about politics. We don't care about people who destroy neighborhoods, who destroy and keep people in jail, and who make sure people are always disillusioned. Thank you.
What's your name and who are you with?
All right, I'm Steve Ongerth. I'm with a variety of groups, but I am the co-founder of the IWW Environmental Unionism Caucus.
And tell the listeners who the IWW is.
The IWW is the Industrial Workers of the World. We are one of the oldest unions in the United States, but in the world too. We were formed in 1905. We believe that capitalism can't be reformed. We have been saying, our organization has been saying things for over 100 years that people in the climate justice movement are saying today, that the source of our problems is an economic system where the powerful privatize the profits for themselves and outsource the costs to the workers, to the communities, and to the environment. And we believe that we can never achieve justice until that system is abolished. And that's what we aim to do. And we see our movement and the climate justice movement as being congruent and having equal and the same goals.
And so where do those dynamics that you described, where do those come down and play out in your personal life, in your neighborhood, and in your community?
Well, I live in Richmond, and I live in the shadow of the Chevron refinery. And I see the machinery of destruction, you know, and I see these oil workers, these refinery workers working there. They risk their lives going in there and taking care of that refinery, operating those systems. They have to work with equipment that is old and failing, and the bosses will not fix it. They want to just keep pushing production because they want to make a profit. And I see these workers risking their lives going in there, working with equipment which is corroding, getting weaker, and now they want to bring in this heavy, dirty crude, which is only going to make it worse, you know. And I see them being put in the middle, you know, of this economic machine that is just absolutely going full bore to destroy the planet for the sake of profit, and of course the need to get off of fossil fuels right now. But you know, these workers, they need a just transition. They need to be given a chance to be a part of this system. So my goal is to help bring these things together. I mean, also I live near major rail lines that are carrying this heavy and dirty crude, and we want that heavy and dirty crude stopped. And
where's the closest rail line to you?
Well, I live within about a half a mile of the BNSF rail line, and not too far away from that is the Union Pacific main line. Both of these are the major main lines in Northern California.
Is that Richmond?
That's in Richmond. They run through the heart of Richmond, and they run through the heart of poor working class communities and communities of color. And the rail workers who haul these long and heavy trains are under constant threat from their boss to cut corners with safety. The bosses are trying to reduce their crew sizes from 2 to 1. They're working long hours. They're under fatigue. They're being asked to drive these longer and heavier trains, which, of course, many of them are carrying dangerous cargo like Bakken crude, which can explode.
So how do you know about the conditions of the workers in these locations?
Well, for one thing, I am a transport worker myself. I am a marine transport worker. I work on the ferry, and I know many railroad workers, and I'm also a solidarity member in the organization Railroad Workers United. I know this because the workers have told me this. And as far as the refinery workers, the communities that are organizing for climate justice have reached out to some of these refinery workers. We've heard some of their stories, and we marched on their picket lines when they were on strike earlier this year, and they've told us what their safety conditions are like. Plus, in March of this year, I helped organize a conference in Richmond of railroad workers reaching out to environmentalists so we could find common ground on the crude by rail issue. And refinery workers were there, and they explained that some of the working conditions that the railroad workers endure, they endure as well.
So you found common ground across industries?
Well, we found the beginnings of common ground. A lot of work has to be done. You know, there's still a lot of trust that has to be built between environmental and climate justice activists and workers working on the front line. But I think we will succeed because ultimately workers and people who care about the climate have the same adversary, and that is this economic system, which is unsustainable, it is dysfunctional, and it is abusive. And ultimately, if we want to have true freedom and live in a world where we can survive, we're going to have to abolish it. And so there is no doubt in my mind that the two movements really should be one. And it's just a question of getting past the propaganda, which is divide and conquer. So when the boss says, you know, oh, those environmentalists, those climate justice people, they want to pass these regulations and destroy jobs. When the bosses say jobs, they really mean profits. Those bosses think nothing about cutting those workers' jobs and about laying them off. 200,000 oil workers' jobs have been lost simply because of the crash of the oil market, because of the price of oil has declined from $114 back in June of last year down to as low as $37 a barrel, and that's not going to change. So more oil workers' jobs have been lost simply because of capitalist market functions than anything else. And those bosses, they'll think nothing about cutting those workers' jobs or cutting their safety concerns. And then they stand up and say, oh, we're the ones defending them and defending their jobs from those environmentalists, those unwashed, out-of-town, jobless hippies on drugs. It's such bullshit. And if you know what you're talking about, you do the research.
I have to edit out that word. You can't use words like that on the radio.
Oh, sorry. Well, you know what I mean. It's bullocks, as they say in England. It's easy to see through it. It's a lie, and it's just a question of getting past the haze of propaganda that's been erected for generations.
So what do you say to people who say either oil, capitalism, either we can't live without them, or they're never going to cease to be? Capitalism is never going to fail. We can't overcome it. What do you say?
I say that's ridiculous. There is plenty of evidence that the world could be run on 100% renewable energy, and capitalism has only existed for about 500 years. It won't, you know, the planet existed for thousands and millions of, you know, 4.5 billion years without it. It'll go on existing without it after it's long gone. The question is, do we want to survive? You know, we have a choice. Either it's capitalism or survival, you know. And we can't survive with capitalism. So capitalism has to be abolished. It's not a question that we can't live without it. We can't live with it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Steve Unger. What's your name and what group are you with?
Jim Dorncott. I'm with Veterans for Peace.
And why are you here at Flood the System about climate change?
You know, one thing veterans understand is the worse the climate change gets out of control, the more wars there will be. And veterans have had enough of war. All you got to do is go out to the hospital and see that. So it's really important for veterans to say, get it under control now. And let's minimize the wars for oil and water and food. These are all unnecessary, and they are going to have a very long-term effect on the generations to come. And it's up to us to take care of the planet so that our children and grandchildren have a place to live together in peace and harmony.
So I see you're a veteran. What war were you in?
I was in Vietnam. 63 to 66, and I was in the Tonkin Gulf on an aircraft carrier, so I learned that the wars are not fought for our protection. They are fought to enable the 1% to ravage the planet, especially the third world and the underdeveloped countries, taking all the natural resources. But the insanity has to stop, because we know that only 1/5 of the fossil fuels can be taken out of the ground. That means 4/5 have to stay in the ground, or the climate will be uncontrollable. And so what they're doing is fighting over fuel and resources they can't even use.
Any final words you want to say to the listening audience?
You know, find some way to get involved. Talk with your neighbors. Talk with your fellow workers. And encourage veterans to speak out about how they understand how they've been used.
Thank you, Jim Dorenkot.
And now back to Post Carbon Radio. We have an interview, pre-recorded interview with Laura Allen on Greywater Systems.
Today on Post Carbon Radio, we speak with Laura Allen of Greywater Action. Laura is the author of The Waterwise Home, How to Conserve, Capture, and Reuse Water in Your Home and Landscape. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
Greywater Action has an interesting history, doesn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about the origin of your organization and how you personally got involved in Greywater?
Sure. Greywater Action started in 1999, very informally. I was living in a rental house with a lot of friends, and my housemate, Cleo Wolfley Erskine, and myself, we decided to build a greywater system after getting a water bill and realizing how much water we used and how we could be putting it to better use. So we, without a lot of prior information, just built a greywater system because we wanted to reuse what we already had. And it was very exciting and fun to get that water outside. And we learned a lot more, improved our system, and over time just kept at it. There's a lot of interest. We wrote a little fanzine about it. At the time, we were called the Greywater Gorillas because everything we did was not permittable, a.k.a. illegal, because California had a very restrictive code at the time, and so you really couldn't reuse your household water in a legal way. And that was a long time ago, and we've grown a lot and become much more formalized and really focus on the education, teaching other people how to do these systems. We focus on the kind of more simple, affordable systems that work really well in residential applications.
Well, let's define some terms. What exactly is gray water? And I've heard the term black water, technically.
So great question. In California, gray water is technically water coming from showers and baths, bathroom sinks, washing machines. Black water is technically toilet water or washing poopy diapers. And kitchen sinks in California are classified as black water, though in other states they aren't.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I think a lot of people might have assumed that kitchen water was gray water. So we're just going to talk about black water for a second, because I know that's not what your organization does, but inquiring minds might want to know. I've heard some firms are looking into ways to use black water, and that conversation is changing a little bit in California. What can you tell us about that? Does Greywater Action ever get involved with black water?
Definitely. I mean, all the water that we use can be reused in some way, and depending on what was put in the water, the way it's going to be reused is different, and there's different levels of risk and different scales of, like, what type of treatment needs to happen. So it really depends on the context. In a residential home, trying to reuse your toilet water doesn't make a lot of sense. But the system to do it safely would be a lot more complicated and expensive. In a residential home, it makes a lot of sense to reuse your gray water, and you could have a composting toilet or some type of waterless toilet. Or in a residential home, if you have a septic system, there are systems that can treat all of the water in the septic tank, which would have toilet water and gray water. They all mix together, and they can be treat that water for irrigation. Pretty challenging to get permits currently in California to reuse that treated septic effluent, so other states allow it. And with our water situation, I think the codes and policies are going to become more up to speed with what's possible and what makes sense ecologically. And then looking at the larger scale buildings, it's very expensive on the big building to separate out the gray water and the black water. And in the larger building, they may not have a lot of landscaping, and so a gray water system could be used toilets, and the type of systems that do that are going to be more complicated, and the treatment needs to be more because the water is going to be coming back into the building. And so in larger buildings, it often makes a lot more sense to just keep the sources of the water together as they are going down the drain, so the toilet combined with the showers, and then you have a centralized treatment system in the building that treats all of the water, black water, mixed with gray water, and then that non-potable water can be reused for toilet flushing or potentially irrigation. And so that's a conversation that's happening, and there are buildings that have that. In San Francisco, the Public Utilities Commission, their new building in downtown San Francisco has a black water treatment system. So it's definitely possible, and we just need to catch up with our policies and make sure the systems are done in a safe way.
Well, Laura, I'm especially interested in what you have to say about gray water system, because we are installing one, and we hope to hook it up with our kitchen sink. So everything you're saying, we are concerned about vegetative matter clogging, and, you know, how would we filter out some of that vegetative matter that might be coming through?
Yeah, kitchen water. I personally think kitchen water should be considered gray water, possibly dark gray water. It has more food material, it has more grease. It definitely has more potential to clog the system up, but it's safe to reuse. And the bacteria in the water that's unsafe should gray water is never considered potable. So any system, any gray water system should flow the water so it's soaking into the ground. There's no contact with people. So that said, to have a kitchen sink system, to have it legal, we have to change policy, which I'm working on, and I hope other people will help with that, because kitchens can be a great supply of irrigation water. To have a functional system, putting the permitting question aside, the easiest way to design a kitchen sink system, from my experience, is to have larger outlets where you don't try to filter out the gunky stuff before it gets into the landscape. You let it all flow through the piping, and then you use wood chip filters that are, you basically just remove some soil and replace it with wood chips, and that's going to be like a biofiltration system that's very simple, it works very well, and all that grease and food particles get stuck into the wood chips, the water soaks down, waters the roots, and then you on occasion need to remove the wood chips as they become kind of full of food particles. And also a lot of composting happens, so nature helps a lot. Earthworms come, soil microbes, you know, nature just starts to decompose that material, and then you on occasion will have to remove it and replace it with fresh wood chips.
I think the way we're designing our system through a local installer is we have a 250-gallon tank, which is going to has a filter, and we'll store the water. Do you have any comments about that?
That sounds like a terrible idea. I would highly recommend you do a little more research and maybe find some alternatives. Storing gray water in an application like yours will cause odor. It'll cause more maintenance. It's the quality of the water goes down. Gray water is best when it just goes right out into the landscape to irrigate as quickly as possible.
Laura, I have a question for those of us who are not that advanced in our systems. What about just carting out your gray water in buckets?
Yeah, anyone can get a bucket and put it in their shower. And the water, when you turn on your shower, it's often not hot, and we wait for it to heat up. And that water is totally clean. It's called clear water, and you can catch that in a bucket and then use that to water houseplants, to bucket flush the toilet, take it outside. And then people do get really creative with using buckets to move gray water around in different ways they collect it. There's also siphoning. You can siphon your bathtub water out, ways where you don't have to change your plumbing.
So back on sort of more technical stuff, let's talk a little bit about the science of gray water. I know that Gray Water Action did a study a while back about the impact of putting gray water on soil around homes. What was that study about, and what were the results?
So we studied, backing up a minute, there's very few studies in the United States that look at actual gray water systems from a real home with real products with a real landscape. There's a lot of laboratory-based studies, and internationally there are studies on real gray water systems, but there's very few in this country. So we wanted to really see what's in the water, how is it affecting the soil, how is it affecting plants. And then we also were curious about maintenance and user satisfaction and other questions around people's experience with the system. And we looked at a bunch of systems in Central California, so the Bay Area, Sonoma County, Santa Cruz area. And we had interviews, site visits, plant observations. We tested soil and gray water. And we found that the plants grew healthily under a wide range of conditions. We didn't see any changes in the soil from the gray water system, really at all. Most of the participants in the study had switched their products, so they were using what we call plant-friendly products, which don't contain harmful compounds that could harm the plants. But there were a few that did, and even the ones that weren't using the right products, their landscape was not being damaged. Though we still encourage people to use the right soaps because over time, you know, there could be problems could arise over time. We found that the quality of gray water was suitable for irrigation for pretty much all of the sites that were using the plant-friendly products. The quality of gray water that came back from the lab that said it was hazardous to plants, those were the few sites that were not using the right soaps. Though we didn't see problems with their plants, but the quality of irrigation was not good.
That's interesting. Gray water installation is now a cottage industry, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep. There are a lot of people that want to get help with their installations.
How would you characterize the growth and changes in that industry?
I think because of the drought, there's a lot more interest and a lot more demand. People who currently had a business doing gray water installations before the drought, they are extremely busy. And new installers who are just incorporating it, it's pretty easy for them to start getting jobs and bringing that into their business. It still is I think for people to have a successful business, they need to have a broader range of offerings than just gray water at first, when they're getting started. It's a really good match for landscapers who already are working in the landscape to bring gray water into their palette of options for people, as well as for contractors and plumbers.
Is it a licensed profession?
Licensing requirements in California are triggered by how much you charge for the job. So if you charge more than $500 for a job, you're required to be a licensed contractor. What particular license you have, gray water kind of fits into different licensing because a little bit of it's plumbing, a lot of it's landscaping. So people tend to either partner with different contractors or they are licensed themselves.
Well, now we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about weather and climate. For the last 4 years, we've all been about drought. And even with El Nino brewing off the coast, we still might have to deal with tons more drought. We just don't know. But looking into the fall, we also may have to deal with downpours and deluges. What is the role of gray water systems during a wet winter? And what should people be doing to prepare their water storage and reuse systems for the possibility that El Nino will really soak us this winter?
Oftentimes during a deluge, the best thing to do is shut off your gray water, and most often. If there's ever water surfacing in your yard from rain, gray water should be shut off and not be going out into the landscape. But that's where rainwater harvesting is a great partner with gray water, because we can store rainwater. It's much cleaner. It's easy to set up a system where there's some simple filtration to keep out mosquitoes and debris, and then we have a great supply of water we can store up as long as we need to. So we can think about how much of that water can we store, where are we going to put it, and also designing our landscape so it can soak up and infiltrate as much water as possible.
Great. And to be clear, the reason you shut off your gray water during a deluge is because gray water is supposed to soak into the ground and get transformed, like you said, and incorporated rather than running off into other surface waters, right?
Exactly. So gray water contains nutrients, and nutrients in your landscape are a good thing. They help your plants. But if we're putting nutrients into other water systems, that causes pollution. It's a source of pollution. So gray water should never leave your property. It should never enter a waterway or a storm drain. There's setbacks from bodies of water to make sure gray water soaks through soil before it ever gets into a waterway, if you are close by one.
How have the techniques and tools of gray water installation changed over the last decade? Is there anything new, or is it basically really simple?
There's always new things, and with gray water and with many things, the more simple you can be, the easier the system will be to maintain, the longer it will last, the better it will work. So there's a kind of a misconception around gray water that these more complicated systems that have more components, they might have tanks and pumps and filters, that they're going to create a better system, and that is definitely not always true. It's often untrue. It's often makes a worse system, but of course it depends on the situation, because some systems do require those components while others don't. One thing that has changed pretty dramatically in the last 10 years is this permits in California. Since 2009, you actually don't need a permit at all, and you can have a legal system when it's coming from your washing machine, and you follow basic guidelines. You're one or two family home, so it's just a residential home. And so you can install your system directly from the washing machine discharge hose and sending that water out into your landscape. So you don't actually have to change your plumbing. And that's a very popular system because it's legal without a permit, and it's pretty simple to install.
So what's the threshold where it does require a permit? What step up from that very simple valve would cause me to need to get a permit before I could install something?
If you change your household plumbing in any way, then you are required to get a permit.
That's simple.
Yeah.
Okay. And then where do you get the permit from? How do you decide what to install? Do people do it themselves, or is this you have to hire a plumber?
It depends. For residential people, I would say the kind of best bet system to start with is that laundry system called Laundry to Landscape, because it's the simplest. If you're a handy person, you can install it yourself in a day or two. It takes like really pretty basic irrigation component, working with irrigation parts, some basic construction. But if you're someone that your window breaks, you change it, you put a fence up, you know, that kind of level of skill, you can do this system. If you don't have time or whatever reason, then that's when you look to a professional. The systems where you're altering your plumbing, where you have to go into your house, identify the right drain, cut into it, put in the diverter valve, that's going to trigger the permit. And it also might be much more complicated depending on what your existing plumbing is like. Some people have really straightforward plumbing. It's made out of plastic, easy to do. Others have really old plumbing made out of metal that's corroded, and if you just tap it, you're going to cause leaks all up and down the line. So there's a huge range within changing plumbing. Going to the permit question, if you live in a city, in an incorporated area, you get the permit from your building department. If you live in an unincorporated area, then you have to go to your county environmental health, and potentially you'll be required to get two permits, which adds a pretty steep cost.
Laura, you give workshops, right, in installing gray water systems?
We do, yeah.
Uh-huh. Can you describe what your workshops are like and what happens after the workshop when participants go home?
We do a bunch of different types, from the really general presentations for people that maybe they've heard of gray water, but they don't really know what their options are. They don't know the levels of complexity and costs, that kind of thing. And then we do workshops for people that really know they want to build like a laundry to landscape system. They've done a little bit of research. They know that's the best thing for them to start with, or they want to do it. And we take them through the design process. So they, when they leave the class, they have a materials list and drawings of what they need to do when they get home. Then we do a hands-on workshop where we build a system with a group of people in a real house. So people get to see from start to finish the whole process. And then we also do an intensive for professionals. It's a five-day training for people that want to incorporate gray water into their business.
So that sounds like a great range of options for classes. What else would you like people to know about gray water and water conservation and reuse that you think a savvy green audience like ours might not already know?
I think that The gray water is a really great source of water for your landscape when we're trying to reduce our production of potable water. And it's also a great way to, it's a great guide to look at your landscape and think about if your goal is to not water with potable water, gray water is going to guide you into where you can locate plants that require frequent irrigation. It can help guide you into the best placement of your other alternative supplies like your rainwater system, because it is limited. You can't go anywhere with the water. It has a lot to do with where your fixtures are currently located and how your house is built. And that limitation can be really helpful to make a plan, a landscape plan, using gray water as your supply of water, and with the goal being you're not going to irrigate with potable water for the most part.
One follow-up question on that. That would seem to me like it raises the question of fire versus water in my mind around your home. Because if the gray water is sort of going to pull you toward planting trees closer to your home, isn't the fire department going to say, you know, you've got to keep that stuff away?
Fire requirements do vary. And so gray water systems, they don't have to irrigate totally close to the home. It depends on your house. In general, it is easier. And in general, many people do irrigate within, you know, 50 or so feet of their home. If the yard is sloping downward, you can go much farther. If your yard's going uphill, you're going to incorporate a pump, and then you don't really have a limit to how far you go. So that's going to be a requirement, too, if people are in that, looking at your local requirements are going to influence plant placement.
Do people use gray water for watering their vegetables?
Yes, they do. The simple systems are really best suited for larger plants. And so I encourage people to first choose plants that are going to be easiest to keep happy, and that's going to start with your trees and easiest to install the system. So starting out with the bigger plants like your trees, your bushes, your shrubs. And the simple systems are great for pretty much any plant that's the size of a tomato plant and larger. They're not good for a lot of small plants because of the distribution limitations of them. And the health concern with gray water is that it's a non-potable source of water, so you don't want anyone to ever ingest it after it's gone through the drain pipes. So with food, you can safely water food plants. You just don't want it to touch the part of the food you're going to eat. So the code does not allow root vegetables or any portion of the plant where the edible part's going to be touching the ground.
I see. Laura, can you you have a website?
We do, graywateraction.org. We have a lot of resources. We have a forum for technical questions. We have just a bunch of information on it.
And they can find out how to contact you and any upcoming workshops that might be accessible to the West Marin community or how to arrange one?
Yeah, they can see workshops. We don't really do a lot of workshops in West Marin, but there are other resources that they could get on our website. And there is a group called Water Now that works in Marin County that's put on some trainings. So that's another, we have a link to them on our website, as well as Daily Acts, which is in Sonoma County. But there's some groups that do a little more local education that people could check out.
Great. Well, you've been listening to Laura Allen from Gray Water Action, giving us some updates on how to install gray water around your home. Thank you, Laura, for being on Post Carbon Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So that was an interview with Laura Allen. She's author of The Waterwise Home, How to Conserve, Capture, and Reuse Water in Your Home and Landscape. And now I'd like to read off our climate calendar for events and actions coming up. On Sunday, October 4th at Spirit Rock, there's a Day of Connection, Sustainable Practice for a Sustainable World. And that's from 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 a.m. with several presenters. And then on Saturday, October 14th, a Pro Solar Rally at PG&E San Francisco offices. And Saturday, November 21st, there's going to be a mass mobilization to express your support and commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And that's going to be in Oakland. They'll meet at Lake Merritt at about 10:30 in the morning and then march to Frank Ozawa Square. So mark your calendars, that, and then thank you for listening to Post Carbon Radio, and stay tuned for Cruising with Rick Clark.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas? We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind. Climate's on my mind, the 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 climate's on my mind.
The most abundant greenhouse gas is carbon dioxide, beats a methane, nitrous oxide, and the F gases by landslide. Everyone releases it when they drive, unless you have an electric ride. It's almost 400 parts per million, and the main reason for climate's rise. Deforestation makes it worse when the trees decay. CO2's dispersed, also dead trees can't breathe it in. Makes it hard to cut back our emissions. Temperature is on the rise, all other animals can blame us, because we are where the fault lies, and it's coming back to maim us. Rising climate poses many problems to the human race. Extreme weather like Katrina and Haiyan, we'll have to embrace. The glaciers are melting, and the sea level's rising at a fast pace. People living on the coast are going to be displaced. Certain species extinct, less water to drink. Other areas too wet, floods a big threat. Other areas dry out, susceptible to drought. Agriculture hit hard, coral reefs will be marred.
We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until
we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind, the climate's on my mind.